is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 225, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And my next book, which is titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, will be published on May 25th, and you can pre-order the Kindle version on Amazon right now. This week, I'm talking to Alan Levine about his UFO experiences. Alan is a former investigator for the Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization. He has also worked as an intelligence analyst in the private sector, working closely with the Joint Terrorist Task Force, the FBI, and Homeland Security. Alan went on to create makeup special effects, masks, and props. Alan has done work on Iron Man 1 and 2, Captain America, and the Avengers. He has also worked for Disney and Lucasfilms. He won the DC Comics Industry Award for his Arkham Asylum Batman costume.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's great for you to come. You've got so much experience. All the work you've done throughout your life and your own UFO experiences. So could we start by talking about your experiences? What happened to you in 1974?
I was on my way to pick up my then fiance. And during those years, I was very, very prompt and very set in routine. And I left my house at exactly 7:30. This was on July 20th in Tucson, Arizona. And I was exiting the parking lot. I was living in a townhouse then. I was exiting the parking lot, going north out of the parking lot towards the Catalina Mountain Range. And at that time in the summer, 7:30 is just beginning sunset. So it was still, you know, fairly light outside, but it was getting dark quickly. And as I was pulling north out of the driveway, I saw above the Catalina Mountains what I thought was the North Star. And it was so bright and so prominent, I thought, gee, you know, that must be why mariners at sea use the stars to navigate. That's literally what I thought. I said, it's so bright. I don't recall it being that bright, but there it is. And so I pulled onto the street that was Bellevue Street, and I turned left going towards what would be, I believe it's Craycroft Street. So I'm going westward, and it's getting dark quickly. And out of the passenger side of the car, I was driving a huge car, Oldsmobile Delta 88. And, you know, we used to call them land yachts. They're so huge. And I was able to look out the passenger window, and I could still see what I thought was the North Star, but it was moving. And I go to myself, oh, it's obviously not a star. That must be the police helicopter. We had one police helicopter in Tucson at the time. And when they would turn on their spotlight, you know, it was very, very bright. I thought, oh, they must be looking for something. And as I'm driving down the street, and this is a residential area, so I was driving fairly slowly, I could see it moving parallel to the car. And as I continued driving, it started getting closer and closer. I thought, oh, there must be something going on around here. And it got brighter and brighter. And I thought, that's not, you know, can't be the police helicopter, because it would just look like a large, bright orb, you know, in the sky. It was starting to get dark now. And as I'm approaching this crossing street, it swooped over the street I was on Bellevue, like a pendulum, basically, from the north to the south, and then swung back again over, centering over the street, and I could see it right out my front window, and I stopped the car. It had gone from this bright orb to what I would describe as about two-thirds the size of the full moon. And you could see through it. It was like if you were to take a magnifying glass, large magnifying glass, and place it on the sky, in the center, that it magnified the stars behind it. But around the outside of this thing, it there was like a ring of, I would describe it as blue lavender light whirling around the exterior of this object. And I was just dumbfounded. I stopped the car, I put it in park, it was still running. And I'm just looking at this thing going, what the heck is this? And it was, and I've heard other people describe this in my investigations. It was close enough you could hit it with a baseball. And it literally was. And I'm staring out from a window. I'm thinking, no one's going to believe, you know, what I've seen here. And I look in my rearview mirror to see if any cars were coming up behind me downstream. And there was nothing. I could see all the way down almost to Alverdon Street, which was a few blocks back. And there were no cars coming that way. And on Craycroft Street in front of me, there were cars going north to south, but no cars coming down my way. I could like, somebody must be seeing this thing because it was so brilliant in the sky. And I'm sitting there in a car looking at it, but it's probably about 30 seconds, 45 seconds gone by. And I make the foolish decision. I got to get out of my car and see what this thing is. And looking back on it now, I would have, you know, cheered, but I don't do this. You don't even know what it is. But I get out of the car and I'm looking at it, and immediately I regret doing that. And I think this thing could be something radioactive. I'm thinking, am I getting like radiated here? I don't even know it. And just that adrenaline started to flow in my body, just like, you know, how you feel like just rising up, you know, from your feet to your head. And I'm thinking maybe I should get back in the car. I had that flight or fright response. And that's when, I've heard other people describe these kinds of communication, but that's when it was just as if someone was standing there behind me or next to me. A voice, ultimately it was in my head. There was no one there. You're in no danger. We mean you no harm. That's exactly what said. I just like froze. It startled me at first because I thought there was someone near me talking to me. That's how pronounced it was. It was, people have asked me, was it a male voice or female voice? I'd say it was just a voice. I wouldn't describe it as male or female. And instantly almost I felt, and it was so pronounced. It was just like someone injected me with something. There was just suddenly a euphoria, almost as if I was drugged. And I realized at the time, and I can still feel that intensity even it to this day, how euphoric I felt and how good I felt. And I go like, what is this? I was just, you know, dumbfounded. And I'm still watching it, and it just whisked away. I don't know if you ever had one of the old TVs back in the 60s and 70s, when you would turn them off, the picture would just, disintegrate into a dot and zip off. That's exactly what this looked like taking off into the west and was gone. And I go, what did I just see? What just happened? And I thought, my girlfriend, she always used to wait outside in front of her mother's place for me to pick her up. So I thought maybe she saw it too. Somebody had to have seen this in the sky. And I get over there, I'm all excited. And this euphoria was starting to wear off. But like I said, it was drug-like. It wasn't like I was just happy or excited. It was like I was literally high, basically. And, did you see it? Did you see this? And I described to her, and she goes like, no, you know, I wasn't looking, you know, in that direction. I thought, you know, I was so disappointed. No, it's not. And, we went out, and I didn't mention it anymore. Just forgot about it. Well, the next day I was going over to my friend's house, Bill Madonna. He was a friend from way back in elementary school. I was going over to his house. He wasn't there. His brother Steve was there.
And I shared with him what had happened the night before. And he says, oh, you should, call APRO and report it to him. And I go, oh, yeah, I've heard of them. Because APRO was well-known. Arizona is well-known for UFO observations. There's plenty of incidents there. And they, Jim had been on the news. Jim Lorenzen had been on the news. Or Coral. And I go, I'm going to call them. And maybe someone else saw the same thing. And so we took out the telephone book. Back then, there's no internet or anything. Looks like enough. We got a telephone book, looked up APRO, and gave them a call. And Jim Lorenzen answered. And I shared with him, what I'd seen, when I'd seen it, all the details that I just shared. And he's asked a few questions. And I said, has anybody else reported this or seen? Did they see it last night? He goes, no, not so far, but we'll take down all your information and if anything comes up, we'll give you a call back. I was a little crestfallen that no one else had seen it because I go like, it was so incredible. And I wanted that validation that someone else had seen the same thing I saw. And at that time, I had just graduated from school, and I had planned to go to the university, and I was going to go into aerospace engineering. And I already had 6 years of machine engineering and drafting in my school curriculum. I had actually won a couple of awards, international awards, for my designs and stuff. And I was also an artist, amateur artist. I thought, hey, maybe I can go over there and just, do something with them, to make models of UFOs, or just kind of sell myself to them as an artist and, mechanical engineer, and maybe do something in some way, get connected, because this sounds like a cool operation. So I looked up their address again in the telephone book, and they were just literally a few blocks from my home. And so I went over there expecting to see some type of office, but they were at that time in 74 still operating out of their house. And it was a cute little, picture book type house with a white picket fence. And on the mailbox at the street, it said APRO. I go like, oh, this little home operation. So bold as I was at the time, I just went to the front door, knocked on the door, and Jim answered the door. And I shared with him who I was, that I'd talked to him the day before. And he said, oh, come on in. He invited me into the house, very tiny house. Coral was there at her typewriter. She had a little Underwood Hunt and Peck typewriter, and nothing electric at that time. Just the thing looked like it was 30 years old. And they just took to me right away, and I took to them. They were like surrogate parents. And I shared with them, my education and my artistry background, and explained, what I was looking to, to do, and said, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, maybe we can, use you to do something like this. And I thought, oh, great, So a few weeks went by. Jim gave me a call, and they had gotten an office, a regular office, which wasn't far from their home. And this was the first office I worked in, and it was fairly large. It wasn't huge, but it was, a good size office, particularly for those days. And I went over there, talked to him, and he gave me my first assignment, basically. And it wasn't to do... he wanted me to take sketches, but it was basically an interview thing. They wanted me to interview this woman who claimed to have ongoing contact with aliens. He wanted to get my take on it and draft up anything that they came up with. And so I went over to the lady's home, and she was, in fact, an artist herself and had paintings of these aliens that she claimed to have contact with. And I spoke to her for probably an hour, you know, interviewed her, took some notes. And there was nothing really to draft. This was just like many people that claim to have ongoing conversations, communications with the extraterrestrials. And there was nothing that stood out in my mind as there was no physical evidence. There was no landings. There was nothing like this. It was just all conversations that she received in her head. I thought, well, okay, you know, there's no proof here. There's no meat that we can get into or do any on the ground. You know, there was no physical evidence or anything. But I went back to the office, shared Jim what I'd learned, and gave him my notes. He says, in the future, he says, try to memorize this stuff. Don't put anything down on paper. I thought, fucked along. What was this, a memory test? You know, and being ignorant at the time of anything to do with, you know, intelligence gathering, or that this would be something ongoing as time goes on, that no, you don't put anything, you don't write anything down. You don't put anything down that could be stolen or fall into the wrong hands or whatever. You keep everything in your mind. And I became very good at that. And using word associations stuff to memorize, you know, what I was told and everything, and didn't take notes again. The only other time I ever sat down and actually wrote down notes was when I did an interview of a Betty Hill that was set up for me by Jim. That was quite a few years later in 79. Well, anyway, that was my first interview. And from then things ramped up very quickly. We got a spectacular contact of Sergeant Charles Moody, abductee in Alamogordo, New Mexico. He was an Air Force sergeant. And it's a case that no one seems to talk about. You'll find one poorly researched paragraph or so on the internet, and a lot of blogs have reposted that thing again and again. It's not very accurate at all. But Charles had gone out. He had just bought a brand new Corvette, and he had taken it out to the desert to watch a meteor shower off base. And he was laying on the hood of his car looking at stars, and he saw what he thought initially was a meteorite coming down. And he started to freak out a little bit because it looked like it was going to hit the ground, you know. And he said within seconds, it was right in front of his car, a large saucer-shaped, you know, craft. He said it was the same color as his Corvette, that metallic gunmetal gray. And he said he sat up quickly, and as he did, four figures came out of the shadow from underneath it and grabbed him. And he's a big guy, but he was embarrassed to share that they were able to overpower him. And he said he didn't understand how they were able to do this. And in the darkness, he thought they were Chinese. He looked at him, he thought that these were Chinese kidnapping him. And they took him to the ship, and he said he was totally paralyzed from the neck down. He could move his head, but couldn't move his arms or legs. And they just kind of grabbed him and got him into the ship and brought him onto this main floor. He was laying on the floor, you know, hands and legs together, you know, hands to his side, laying on the floor. And what he described as a leader, I came to him and was telepathically speaking to him. And he said, if you stop struggling, we'll release you, but you have to promise not to struggle or fight if we do. And so he, you know, nodded his head that he wouldn't, you know, struggle the leader, and this is something that you'll hear about in many, many abduction cases, had a rod in his hand that he touched him with, and the paralysis disappeared. And he sat up, got up off the floor, and he described these creatures similarly as all people describe grays, between 4 to 5 feet tall, bald, large Asian looking eyes, wrapped around the head a little bit. Small mouth, small nose, typical gray. And Charles was very excited, but he kept his head in asking questions. So a lot of abductees, of course, obviously they're so stunned and startled that they just don't know what to say or what to ask. But he, being in the military and particularly in the Air Force, he knew exactly what to ask. Who are you? Where are you from? What is this, craft? How does it run? These questions. And the leader was quite, chatty, telepathically, and, agreed to answer his questions. And he told Charles, to the question, who are you? Where are you from? He says, we're scientists, historians, traders and explorers just like you. I've got that a little bit mixed up in the order, but that's what he shared. And I always took that as that makes perfect sense. It covers the whole exploration the cycle here, historians, doctors, scientists, traders, etc. And we're just like you. So Charles wanted to know how the ship ran and, how it was propelled. And so the leader took him down like a little elevator kind of thing they got into, and he went down to the lower part of the ship and got out. And below the ship, there were like 3 pods that were visible from the exterior, but he was on the interior. And this is something that would come up almost a decade later, chaired by Bob Lazar. And I'll speak about that a little bit later. But Charles described that outside these pods were large, what he described as oil drum looking things. They were pointed down into the pods that were hanging from what he described as like PVC looking piping. And the leader described these as gravity emitters. And this is how the ship ran. And Bob Lazar, later on, when I first heard his description, what he was working on, it was identical, only that he was looking from that upper floor through a manhole down into the lower part of the craft, and described the identical thing. And one of the things we did at APRO, if we did a press release or whatever, we didn't tell everybody everything. We kept things to ourselves so that if someone tried to copycat or whatever, tried to hoax something, they wouldn't know all the exact details. And that was a detail that Charles had shared with us that we had never released to anybody. So when I heard Bob share this identical description, I go like, how the heck would he have known this, without having seen this same thing? They submitted Charles to a number of medical examinations, which he agreed to allow them to do. And he asked them different things, what are you doing now? What are you doing this? And they said, and this was very similar to something that Betty Hill shared with me that had happened to her, years before this incident. They ran a rod around his extremities and stuff. And they told him they were measuring his nervous system. And then they flipped him over and they put something on the back of his head at the base of his skull. And the alien told him, hey, this may hurt for a moment. And once you leave, you won't remember this happened, but in a couple of weeks, you should go, you will recall this, and you should go get this checked out. Make sure there's no, you know, nothing wrong here. And he said that it felt like a little pinch, and that was it. They you know, turned him back over. And the next thing he remembered was he was sitting in his car, in his Corvette, and the engine was running, and he saw the ship speed off into the night. And he looked at his watch, and a couple hours had passed, and he was kind of like foggy. And as he drove, it was just like a dream disappearing. You know how you dreamt something, but then you wake up and the whole thing goes away. And that was what he described. And by the time he got back to his home, he didn't remember what had happened. He just knew he'd gone out to the meteor shower, didn't remember what had happened. He went to bed. And the next morning he got up and he felt a pain in the back of his neck at the base of his skull. And he felt, and there was something like a scab there. And he took a second mirror and looked, you know, to see the back of his head and saw there was like a little bloody crustacean in the back of his head. And he was like, well, how did this happen? And he didn't think much of it. But a couple of weeks later, everything started coming, just as the leader had said, everything started coming back. Oh my God, you know, this happened. And he was afraid to tell anybody about it. But he thought, I better go to the doctor and get this checked out. So he went to the base doctor and, you know, explained, you know, that he had injured himself somehow back of his skull. Can you take a look at it? And the doctor says, yeah, he says, you know, looks like there's, you know, you cut yourself. There's an incision or something here. Charles then, you know, told him what he believed happened. And he says, okay, you need to talk to your base commander about this. And so he did, and he contacted APRO was the main UFO reporting institution worldwide at that time. MUFON was starting to get going, but it was nothing compared to what APRO was doing. At our pinnacle, we had 3,000 members, and most of them were investigators all over the world, Japan, South America, Europe, Asia. And so we're well known. And he contacted us. He spoke to Jim. And Jim gave him to me to interview. He says, I want you to call this guy. I do an in-depth interview. And so I called the base. They put me in touch with him through the base operator. And I did three interviews. In-depth interviews with him, and very nice guy, very cogent, didn't seem to have any issues. And I thought, well, this is huge, because this was before ever speaking to Jesse Marcel from Roswell. We had an Air Force sergeant blamed abduction, seemed, you know, very legit, you know, a very credible individual. This is going to be huge. And shared it with Jim, and we're you know, every time I spoke to Charles and got all the details and the description of the ship, and we were planning, okay, we're going to do a press conference and we're going to roll this all out. This is going to be incredible. You know, we were getting ready, you know, we thought, here it is. This is because, again, there was no one like this before this. There was no military individual coming forth that said they were abduction by aliens and had, you know, an incision on the back of their head. We wanted to get him examined by our own physicians, because we suspected even at that time that something had happened, that there was an implant or something in him. We wanted to get him, you know, x-rayed at the time. CAT scans were still kind of not routinely used at that time. And we wanted to physically examine it. We wanted Leo sprinkle our hypnosis to put him in regressive hypnosis and get all these things done. So I called the base to speak to him, start making arrangements. And, you know, the see, you know, we're going to have to fly out there. Or he's going to fly to Tucson. And the base operator answers, and, you know, I said, can you connect me with Sergeant Moody, blah, blah, blah. And she said, I'm sorry, we can't. I said, well, oh, he's not there? And she said, he's been transferred. I said, transferred? Transferred where? You know, can't say. What do you mean you can't say? You want to know where he was transferred to, you know, you, it's the Air Force, you know. She said, you know, nope, can't say. And, you know, he won't, you know, won't be back here. I asked him if he would be returning to the base, you know, after this transfer thing. Nope. That was it. She was very short, very curt. And I'd spoken to this woman 3 times previously, and she had always been very nice and very eager. And that was it. I have not been able to find him. No one, there's nothing on the internet, you know, more about what happened to him, where he went, where he was transferred to. And this was something that Jim warned me about could happen to him in my conversations, you know, with him after, you know, the other three previous interviews. I said, you know, this is going to be great, exciting. He says, well, you know, he says he may be transferred to parts unknown, and they may, you know, silence him some way. And I thought, no, that's movie stuff. It's going to be fine. It's going to be really exciting. And no, Jim was right. They transferred him, and we never heard of him again. And what happened to him? I have no idea.
It seems that the UFO that you saw in 1974 was like a kick that sprung you forward to contact APRO, and then you got work there, and your whole investigation started throughout your life with UFOs. Do you think perhaps the UFO was there for that reason? It was just for you?
You know, it's, believe me, there's not a day that goes by that I don't muse about these incidents and what happened. I bring up how precise I was in those days, you know, how prompt I was to do things. And when I would pick up my girlfriend for a date, I always left the house not at, you know, like 7:15 or 25 after. It was always exactly at 7:30 prompt. And because I knew exactly how long it would take to get over to her place. And so the thing I asked myself is, was that incidental? Was I just at the right place at the right time and saw that UFO over the Catalinas? Or was it waiting for me? Did it know that, yeah, he leaves exactly at 7:30 and we're going to be waiting for him when he comes out? Because it was, you know, like I say, it was, what are the chances that I was going to see that, that I would have even looked up over the Catalinas and noticed it? But, it, you know, did I notice it, or did it draw me to notice it? Because, of course, when I got down the street, they were talking to me. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. But I think the second incident that I had later in 1979, I believe, was due to my direct exposure to all these abductees. And that was, you know, how that I was, again, kind of like at the right place at the right time, you know, all these different abductees. I think I drew attention to myself. And that kind of scared me, too, a little bit. I go like, you know, did I do this to myself? Am I in this predicament because I've exposed myself, you know, to all this strangeness? Kind of like what they refer to today as the hitchhiker effect. Did I bring this stuff home with me? And, you know, I don't know to this day if that was it or not. But it's certainly the second incident, you know, that we'll talk about in a little bit, was one that really was tenfold more than the 1974 one. But Moody really woke me up in that this stuff is bigger than I thought. I mean, the Air Force is actually disappearing this guy because of what he knows. I had, you hear of things going on in government, and you have to also remember, this is a totally different time than it is today. There was no major communications, public media kind of stuff. You had three networks that went off the air at 12 midnight and came on again at 5 or 6 in the morning with the Farm Bureau report. And you got the local news. You might watch Walter Cronkite David and Brinkley on Channel 4 on NBC. But that was the only news we got. You got your local paper. You couldn't go to grocery store and get a New York Times. There was only one magazine store downtown where you could get, papers from other cities, and they were like 3-4 spaces late. So you knew what you knew from your local, news outlets. And much smaller country at the time, I think it was just under 200 million people or 200 million at the time. So it was a much smaller time. And government as a whole seemed more intimate. In Tucson, Arizona, we had Davis Monthan Air Force Base. And at that time, it was kind of an Air Force town. There was only, 150,000 people then at that time, much smaller today. I think Tucson has 2 million people, but back then it was a much smaller town. When I was a kid, we lived close to the edge of town. It was much smaller. And so hearing, stuff about the government can do this and the government can do that and they can, disappear people. We took that serious. We believe that, but it wasn't as serious as today. I go like, well, absolutely, our government, they can certainly do these kinds of things. But back then, I was amazed at, oh my God, this stuff's real. The government really can take someone and disappear them, and they did with Moody. I don't think there's been a night in my life that I haven't gone to bed and that thing pops into my mind. We were living at that. I was married by this time to the same girl that I was with in 74. And we lived in the north part of Tucson, just within walking distance of the Catalina foothills on a street there near the corner of Blackledge and Alvernon. Alvernon's a very major street there in Tucson. But again, Tucson was much smaller than it is today, and you could walk maybe half a mile, you'd be in the Sonora Desert, from where we were. So it was still, that wasn't far from very rural areas, cow ranches and stuff from where we lived. And, we were a young couple, and we were living in a double wide trailer, which people would probably say, oh, you live in a trailer. A double wide trailer back then, that was big. It was 2 bedrooms. And we lived right at the mouth of the trailer court. The driveway entrance was right there where our trailer was. It would be on the west side of the street. The living room was facing the Catalina foothills, the north side. And this was on March 16th, 1979. And my wife was very good, because I'm kind of like a night owl. I'll stay up late working on projects or doing something. But she was always very considerate and would make sure that I would go to bed promptly at 10:30. We would watch George Burns and Gracie Allen's on Channel 11. Kazaz was the call station at 10 o'clock, and at 10:30, she would get up, turn off the television, take me by the hand, take me to bed, because otherwise I would just stay up till, all hours of the night. We went to bed. It was a 2-bedroom trailer. We slept in the larger bedroom in the back of the trailer. And to the south of our trailer was a tiny little travel trailer, one of these little aluminum air, you know, trailers that normally you would hook up to the back of a truck as like for camping. And an old cat woman used to live there. She had like 30 cats. And she must have been in her 80s. And you would see her in the daytime sitting outside her little travel trailer with like 30 cats crawling all over her. And she would just smile. And I never really had a conversation with her, but she seemed friendly enough. I'd say hello to her. And at night, she would, you know, go into the trailer, take half the cats with her, but half the cats stayed out. And it's germane to the story of these cats. Because about 3 or 4 times a week, the cats would get on the roof of our trailer and start fighting and make all kinds of racket. And anything on top of that trailer would just make all kinds of noise. It just, you know, pounding the top of the trailer. So we had just gone to bed, and my wife was a very quick and heavy sleeper. She'd lay down, she was right out. And, you know, basically she was unconscious. And being a night owl, took me a while to fall asleep. So I'm laying there and I hear bang as the cats hit the roof and they start fighting. Bang, bang, bang. And that would just drive me up the wall. I would, again, this adrenaline would start flowing. Oh my God. And so I threw my covers off, jumped out of the bed, and I went to the kitchen, opened the pantry door, and got out a broom. And I would use this broom to smack the ceiling of the kitchen to scare the cats and chase them off the roof. And I would use the bristle part because the ceiling of the kitchen was like a wood paneling. I didn't want to damage it. So I took the bristles and I'm smacking the ceiling, and the cats are yowling and running around, and I'm smacking it some more, and they stop and jump off the roof. Well, in the kitchen, you could see the living room, and in the living room, there were 3 windows, one faced north, one faced west, one faced east. And my wife had made drapes, these golden yellow drapes that went from ceiling to the floor, and they were all lit up, bright. And I go like, there must be a car in the driveway, which was typical. Outside the trailer where we were, at the entrance of the trailer park, there was a sign. It's a Purple Sage Trailer Court. And there was a little lamp there. And back in those days, there was no GPS or anything. If someone got lost, they would pull up to that sign and take out their, you know, map and kind of figure out where they were. Also, across from us, there weren't trailers across the driveway. There were 3 little bungalows. These are very tiny, tiny little homes. And the owner of the trailer park, his daughter, who was a friend of my wife's, lived in the bungalow across from us. And I thought, well, maybe her boyfriend is dropping her off. There's some car in the driveway. Or someone's looking, like I said, you know, directions on a map. And so I didn't pay much attention to the light, everything being lit up. And put the broom away, went back in the bedroom, laid down. 2-3 minutes later, bang, the cats are back on the roof. Bah, 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 bah. I was even more intense. I thought, this has to stop. This just drives me crazy. So I went out, got the broom again. I'm smacking it against the ceiling and they're not going. So I'm just enraged. I spin the broom around and now I'm going to smack the handle against the ceiling. Now I'm thinking to myself, I've got to be careful. I can't hit it too hard because I'm going to make dents in the ceiling if I do that. So I'm smacking it and the cats jump off the roof again. And I see the lights. In the curtains are still all lit up. I go to the east window, which was right by the entrance door to the trailer, and I peek out looking north towards the entrance driveway to see expecting to see a car parked underneath the entrance sign, and there's no car. But everything's still lit up. So I go, well, where's the light coming from? So I look to the south, and I was just stunned. There, sitting across the driveway, there's a little area there between their three bungalows. This was between the second and third bungalow down. There was like a little bare desert area off the driveway. There was a Volkswagen size egg standing, you know, long ways on four little spindly legs. And one of my first impressions was, how can that thing stand on the four little spindly legs? And it was glowing just like the one I had seen in 74, the circle that went around it was like a blue lavender. This was glowing all like a blue lavender. It looked like the thing was white, but it emitted this blue lavender glow all over it. And I didn't know at the time, and I didn't know for years, it was years later that I realized, I learned that plasma emitted into a nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere will create a blue lavender glow because of the electrons and atoms, the molecules that it's stimulating. Well, I didn't know that at the time, but there was blue lavender glow. And there was a large doorway in the center of this egg, and standing in the doorway, and this is something I've never heard any, well, there was one case in France which sounded a little similar, but I've never heard anyone describe a creature or a thing like this. This thing, I could best describe it. I don't know if you're familiar there in Britain with the old stop animation cartoon kids show called Gumpy. But this thing looked like, had a body like Gumpy, but it had a human head with no face, no eyes, no nose, just a human-shaped head. And its hands were mitten-like. It had no fingers, just opposable thumbs, but no fingers. And the arms weren't jointed like the human's arms. They were just like, I would say, tentacle-like. There was no break in the elbow or at the shoulder. They just extruded from the body. Same color as the craft. And it was dark lit behind. I could only see it. I couldn't see anything inside the craft. And it's motioning to me. It's like beckoning me to come outside with his head. And I couldn't believe what I was looking at. I go like, oh my God. And having been with APRO at that point from 74, you know, you hear incidents and stuff. And if I had seen a flying saucer, which was the most typical thing that was being described at that time, I would have expected, oh, it's flying saucer. I had never heard of an egg-shaped craft ever at that point. And I thought, this is something I absolutely would never have expected to see. And this thing's waving at me. I go, somebody, having experienced this in 74, somebody's going to see this. So I run the bedroom to get my wife. Got to come out. And when I go in there, I'm thinking, I'm going to take her back out there and this thing's going to be gone and it's going to be hilarious. So I go back there and I try to wake her up. And as I was sharing, she was just a very, very sound sleeper. And, you know, I had experienced this with her before. If she, you know, would fall asleep on drivers, like, you couldn't wake her up. And so I'm shaking her, waking her up. I literally set her up in bed, pulled the covers off, set her up in bed, said, you got to come out here. You got to come out here and see this. You got to come out to the living room. And she said, whoa, you know, she's trying to wake up. I said, are you awake? You awake? Yeah, I'm awake, you know. And so I run back into the living room, look out the curtain again, and it's still there. Thing raises his arm, beckons to me again, like wants me to come outside. I go, oh my God, it's still there. You know, it's like, and I look down the hallway to see if she's coming. I don't see her coming. And I, I run back there and she's, you know, laid back down. She's back to sleep again. This, I thought, I gotta get her up. Someone else has to see this. I rip the covers off her. I swing her legs out of bed and set her up on the edge of the bed. I said, you got to wake up. This is really important. You got to come out here and see this. And, you know, I set her up in bed. She's, yeah. She was a little bit irritated. Yeah, I'm waking up. And I run back out again. I'm looking out the window. And I look down the hallway to see if she's coming. I see she's sitting on the edge of the bed. So when I look out the window, it's still there. But now, as I shared, there were three bungalows across the driveway there. And the third bungalow had a couple that I had never spoken to, but everyone knew them. We called them the hippie couple. You know, this is 1979. There were still hippies around. And these were what you would describe as hippies or flower children or whatever, you know, a long hair, you know, marijuana smoking guys, you know, guy and gal. And though I'd never spoken to them, they're now outside standing to what would be the southwest of the craft. And they're standing side by side. They're in their bed clothes. She was wearing like a long, you know, t-shirt kind of thing to her knees. And he was in what looked to me like hustle green pants and a black t-shirt. And they're standing right next to the craft, staring at, not staring at me, but just like staring straight out, zombified looking next to the craft. And this thing is still in the craft motioning to me to like come out. I like, oh my God, what's going on here? And I look down the hallway again to see if my wife's coming. She's still sitting on the edge of the bed. I thought, well, I'm going to find out what's going on. I open the door. I step onto the steps. There were like three stairs came up to the trailer. And just like a week before, I had put artificial grass on there to make them look nice. And I still remember to this day the prickly feeling on my feet as I stepped onto that astroturf on the steps. And I'm looking at the craft and I can smell the orange blossom and sage that was around. And I'm looking at the craft and that's it. I don't, it's just like blank. The next thing I remember, it's like my eyes open up and I'm looking up. And I can see it wasn't a full moon. It was like a 7/8 moon above me. And I'm holding on to this rusty ladder on the side of a friggin' grain silo. I kid you not. And I go, where am I? What am I doing? I like froze because, oh my God, I'm, you know, up high and I'm holding on. I could feel the rusty rungs in my hand and on my bare feet. And I feel disoriented. I'm afraid I'm going to fall. And I look down, see how far I am off the ground. And down below me is what is a classic little gray alien. Now, something, and maybe it's just my artist's eye, you know, trained observer kind of thing. I'm looking down at this thing and I can see why. Now, remember, this is under moonlight, so there's no colors. It's like almost like black and white. But I can see why people would refer to them as gray. I would describe it more as a gray pallor, you know, like there's someone sickly or very pale, as opposed to gray like slate gray or, you know, gunmetal gray, but very pale. And I remember, and people describe this all the time, looking at the eyes just like grab you. And I'm looking down, I see this thing and just looked like a black jumpsuit. I couldn't make out any detail on the suit, covered its arms and legs. And I hear my head, just like I did in 74, you know, a voice. And I said, Alan, it's time to come down. We have to go back now. And I go, I think in my head, oh yeah, I promised I wouldn't cause any trouble and I would do whatever they said. And, you know, I don't want to mess this up because they won't, you know, invite me to go along with them anymore. And I saw the little creature down there and go, oh yeah, he's my friend. He's, and I tell you, I felt like I knew this thing. I knew this creature for 100 years. You know, I looked at it and just like, oh, that's my friend. Yeah.
It's been fantastic listening to you talk. I've got maybe 25 or 30 questions left over about all sorts of things. Maybe you can come back on the podcast in a few weeks or a couple of months and we do it again.
I'd be glad to. We can pick up where we left off. Do part two. Find out where this all led to. What we're looking at today, the first legitimate government attempt at disclosure and the involvement of the Carter administration and what I learned a year after, you know, the museum was to open. So there's a lot more ahead.
Fantastic. And that was an interview with Alan Levine about his UFO experiences. I will be publishing my next book soon. It's titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, and it will be published on May 25th. And you can currently pre-order the Kindle version on Amazon. A great way to support this podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.